Hey friends, it's your host, Shane Blackshear. I want to remind you that Seminary Dropout is, yes, supported by listeners like you. You can go to supportseminarydropout.com to check that out. But also, Seminary Dropout is sponsored by Compassion International. I'm so excited to be partnering with Compassion. Compassion is the world's leading authority in holistic child development through sponsorship. They take care of kids, in some cases with prenatal care, and go all the way through leadership development for qualified young adults and everything in between. In a future episode, I'm going to talk about my personal experience with Compassion International, but I highly recommend that you support them, that you sponsor a child. I have for many years, and I'll be talking about that too in that upcoming episode. But for now, go to compassion.com/dropout and check out what they do and sponsor a kid today. All right. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Esther Emery. Esther used to direct stage plays in Southern California, but that was a long time ago. Now she lives with her husband and three children off the grid in a yurt, tending to 3 acres in the foothills of Idaho's Rocky Mountains. She writes about faith and trying to live a fearless and free life. Her new book is called What Falls from the Sky: How I Disconnected from the Internet and Reconnected with the God Who Made the Clouds. Esther, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wonder if you could just describe your spiritual life growing up, yours and your family's.
Sure. My mother was a born-again Christian, and her religion was very heartfelt, very deep. She would go to church, and she would weep. She would just have this extremely physical experience of her faith. My father was not on the same page, and their religious differences are something that I carried as a complex but deeply felt tension. So as a teenager, I kind of looked at my mother's faith and I thought, this is the faith of a child. This is the faith of a country girl. She also had that persona and someone who does not have her eyes open to the realities of the world. And so I turned my back quite securely on what I experienced to be the Christian religion as a whole. And turned my back on it completely and went off on my own way.
Did you ever wonder why you had the awareness as an adolescent to see that in your mother, but she didn't have it to see it in herself?
Well, sure. I mean, every teenager thinks that they know things their parents don't know. I'm afraid I've been brought up short a bit on that one. But sure, I thought that she was taking the easy way, because she would read the Bible and she would read all the good parts. And she would skip the parts about, you know, an infant's head being smashed on the rocks, or the texts of terror, as we refer to them now, or just how this book and this religion was used as a weapon in the culture wars in this world we walked through. She just kind of kept herself floating above that. And to her, it was a personal thing and a real thing. But she just didn't concern herself with those issues that were so important and difficult for me as a teenager.
Did you guys grow up going to church?
Well, yes. My mother was on the road quite a bit. So she's a unique figure, a homesteading teacher, a leader in the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s. She had written a book which was originally called The Old-Fashioned Recipe Book, and then after that, The Encyclopedia of Country Living. And what she was trying to do was to capture a set of skills in the old ways of living, which she saw being lost to urban living and grocery stores. She wanted to write down how to make soap and how to feed yourself from the land. And so she had compiled all this information into a book. That happened in the 1970s, and she happened to ride a wave of national interest in natural living, the Back to the Land movement, it's often called. And so she had quite the following around these issues of agrarian lifestyle and self-sufficiency. And she traveled around the country, at times in a van, at times with several children. And she took her children to communities of people who had shared values with her. So I've been to almost every kind of church you can think of. I have been to the far left. I have been to the far right. I have been to the drum circles. I have been to the very conservative, very close-knit Christian communities. And I think that that actually gave me a sense of what is now a sense of respect and awareness of the diversity of religious expression. But as a teenager, it was just all a little wild.
See, I think that could give me, if I experienced that as a teenager, I think that would give me maybe one of two experiences. And maybe one of them is what you're talking about, just recognizing the diversity of those experiences. I think, too, it might also lead me to believe that maybe we are all just making this stuff up and making religion in our own image.
Oh, absolutely. And when I talk about my issues, how I saw the world differently from my mother, that's exactly what I wondered that she had the naivete, really, to not recognize that she was saying, literally saying different words in different places on different Sundays. And didn't that bother her? But like I said, for her, it was the faith of a child. And she believed so deeply in the core of it that she almost didn't worry when the waters rippled. You know, things would change and things would look different. But she knew what she meant by faith. And she knew what she meant when she prayed. And so that was good enough for her.
I can imagine, too, from your point of view, seeing your mother and you kind of downplayed her, this book that she wrote, like it was a huge deal for a long time. And as you can go and buy it on Amazon today, and I will be owning a copy before the end of this year. But so she was like an author. She was in some way accomplished, like in a even like a worldly sense. And I wonder if you kind of saw that as incongruous with her faith being so childlike.
Well, I have to add a layer of complication before I can answer that, because my mother's career had a real rise and fall to it. In the 1970s, she was literally on TV. She took a goat on late night television, and she went on tour, and a lot of people saw her and appreciated what she stood for. I was born in 1979. And at that time, my family had a series of problems, a health crisis, eventually a divorce, a flash flood. And that was simultaneous with a change in public perception of the Back to the Land movement. So I came into awareness of my mother in the 1980s, at a time when she was a single mother raising me in town in what is probably best described as poverty. And most of the country couldn't care less about milking goats. There wasn't any kind of a zeitgeist that appreciated her identity. I wasn't hearing about it from my peers as I grew older and was concerned about what my peers were interested in. We were doing Pearl Jam and striped tights. We were not doing goat milking or killing your own chickens. So I didn't really have an awareness that my mother's book had had that much of an impact. So I didn't understand until I was an adult that she had had such a significant impact. And my awareness of her having that kind of impact was kind of simultaneous with my own yearning for Christian expression. So I processed all of that at a later age. I was fairly oblivious to it in my teens.
I mean, that's something that you write about. By the time, like you said, by the time you came around, you're the youngest of all your brothers and sisters, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I can see how your mother writing a book like the one she did, really appealing to kind of that last wave of the 70s of hippies and countercultural movements going on, and that really fading away in the 80s, and going from living on, they had like an enormous farm, right? At some point?
Mm-hmm. Nearly 400 acres. Yeah. I mean, that's ranch land.
Enormous, enormous. Going from that to what you got to experience, which was renting rooms in a big house and, you know, having to share a room with your mom, right?
Yeah, and I didn't necessarily even believe it was true. It was this mythology around my family, and my mother's a brilliant storyteller. It was her gift. And so I'd hear her stories, and I would see how they would capture people. And it took me until I had my own feet on the ground to really separate fact from fiction there, to say, oh, she wasn't just telling a beautiful story. I can now meet these people. I can now be introduced to these people whose lives have been transformed by my mother's work. I can now see her name in these newspapers. Someone contacted me, or actually I contacted her this last summer because she had done her graduate thesis for her PhD on my mother.
Oh my gosh. So,
I know, what a turnaround, right? From legitimately believing that she was a has-been or washed up or some relic of an America that really had died and gone away.
You, well, let's fast forward a little bit. You were a really successful and up and coming stage director for a long time. Tell us about the story about what brought you away from that.
What brought me away from theater directing?
Yeah.
Sure. So I loved the theater like it was my family. You know, I had pretended my blood family didn't exist. It was so complicated. It was so traumatic for me. And I really adopted the stage world as my family and as my life. I married someone who was just as passionate about theater as I was, and we kept time by doing plays. We almost didn't have our feet on the ground because we were so immersed in this world of producing entertainment and producing quality entertainment. We had children, and on the first baby, I kind of held it together, and on the second baby, I completely didn't hold it together. Our marriage went into crisis. My career also went into crisis. I wasn't able to hold up really anything. And what happened was that in the moment of my crisis, it was like the window drapes got opened, or the cloth got whisked away, and you could just see that inside, I was completely a shambles. I had been doing successful work, and I had been going through my life, and I had been producing quality work. But on the inside, I didn't have anything solid to stand on. So I found I had no choice but to address some really deep issues in my life.
I think that must be the concept of like the story of someone's kind of life, or at least personal life, kind of falling apart, but being surrounded or having a really strong career. I mean, that's like a very old story, right? But, and I think, I wonder if a lot of times it is because people are so, those people who are super competent at their jobs are even at more risk for that, because I think we really, just as humans, we like to run towards our competencies. And and a lot of times it's so much more easy to be competent at our jobs than it is at our interpersonal relationships.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that when I needed to heal my marriage, so let's just recognize that I had a crisis in my marriage. And when I needed to heal that, I was entering into a space where I had very little competency because I hadn't resolved the issues from my birth family. And I think this is very common too, that we kind of hide our traumas, or we push them down from our childhood. And then we just hope, you know, that we'll make it through somehow. And then you discover at some point, wow, I haven't done the work here because I need to now save my marriage. And I was still very much in love at this point. I still had something to save. But I didn't have that competency. Just as you said, it took a great deal of risk for me to turn towards that area.
Did you see the internet as a problem back then for you?
Sure. At that point, I was becoming a stay-at-home mom. I had been living and breathing the theater for 10 years. Barely even eating, you know, just constantly addressing my passion for creating great storytelling for the stage. And then what Nick and I decided to do was to move across the country so that he could have a better paying job and I could be a full-time stay-at-home mom. It was brutal. It was such a dramatic shift and such a painful one for me. I can't even describe it, that I just went from, it was like going from constant lights and noise to a small padded room. And what I ended up doing was spending every waking minute with a screen open. I would almost, the second that I woke up, I would roll over and get some screen open so that I felt like I had some connection to my people who were 2,000 miles away, or my life, which seemed to be in the past, you know, to look at these kind of, this sense of recognition or identity that was still expressed on the internet. And at that point, I realized I had an addiction problem. I was not able to give my full focus to my children or to my husband or to my new life. I couldn't even unpack my boxes because I was holding on so tightly to the internet as a lifeline in my difficult time.
One of the things that you emphasized was that being a stay-at-home mom is not like a natural vocation for you. I mean, there are people out there who it really is, and they love the idea of staying home with their children, and that's a real calling that they live into. And then there are some people who that's not the case, but they do it anyway. it seems like that was definitely the case for you.
Yeah, I said that it, as marriage was to Juliet, homemaking was an honor that right. I dreamt not of. And I do think that that has to do with personalities. I was very passionate about intellect and knowledge and, to a certain extent, power. I had been driven by speed and the fascination of city life for so long that I didn't have very much, let's use that word competency again, I didn't have very much competency for anything quiet. And preschool games or letters and numbers seemed to me a completely foreign world. And then simultaneous with that, I also was very uncomfortable in the kitchen, which is a primary obligation of the stay-at-home mom.
Going back to the internet, because a lot of this, I mean, really that's the focus of this book, is how your life changed when you decided to quit the internet. Do you feel like you're an addictive person by nature?
Well, sure. I'm a person who does extremes. I like to go all the way in or all the way out. I'm not good with halfway. And that certainly does lend itself to addiction.
Do you remember the moment where you thought, or for the first time, the idea came in your head that you were going to give it up?
Sure. Well, I wanted to give up my cell phone. I was frustrated by my cell phone because it was a certain expense every month. And when I was working, it rang all the time. And when I wasn't working, it was frustratingly silent. And so I found myself kind of picking it up and almost willing someone to contact me to give me both companionship and some sense of validation that I was an important person. So I decided to cancel my cell phone service. We had a landline in the house. And it was at the moment that I was canceling my cell phone service and the person on the other end of the line was trying to convince me to keep it that I made a joke. I said, oh, you know, I can't. There's no convincing me because I'm going for a year without a cell phone because I'm going to write a book about it. And it was entirely a joke. It came from no strong impulse whatsoever. I said it in hopes that I could make my husband laugh and myself laugh. And as it was coming out of my mouth, I thought, I've just written my future. I'm doing this. This is happening. And I've said a few times in the book that I believe God plants little seeds in jokes. And that's very much how it happened for me, that this tremendous transformation and healing that was available to me, I could never have faced it if I had faced it square head on. You know, I wouldn't have been able to believe it if I had seen it head on. But because it came to me in a little laughter, it came to me in something that seemed very light, I was able to start down a road that really changed everything for me and for my family.
In the beginning, you kind of almost went through like withdrawals, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the very first day I actually failed. My first day that I... I had set this up. I was going to go for a year without the internet. And I had prepared. I had let everyone know that that's what was happening. And on the first day, by noon, I was on the internet. That taught me something about the level of my addiction.
Yeah, I think that would be a real eye-opener, because I think part of addiction is that it's so elusive, and that the person who's addicted can rarely acknowledge that. And it's only when you try to do without that you have to come to terms with how much you felt like you needed it.
Sure. You can go through every day saying, oh, I'd be fine without this. It's not a big deal. Then the moment that you actually do that, then you have some new realizations about yourself.
What did you miss most about it?
It changed at different times, but the thing that I literally couldn't live without, that I had to change myself in order to learn how to live without, is the sense of validation. We certainly laugh about it. We joke about how much we need our Facebook likes or our Instagram likes, but they are standing in for something very real, which is the world seeing you. You know, you put yourself out onto the internet in some form, and the world sees you and gives you some kind of a mark or acknowledgement that you were there. And I came to realize that without that, I wasn't entirely sure that I was still there. I wasn't entirely sure that I existed, which is a kind of profound and scary place to be, to have that kind of self-awareness. And I appreciate this now, because I understand so much more about what it means to be resilient and what it means to be self-assured or self-sufficient than I did then. But it was a trial by fire. You know, I really would have liked somebody to just tap me on the shoulder now and then and say, hey, you're doing good. I see you. Looks good. Keep going.
I think part of what I think about when I think about you going through this is, you know, it's one thing that to do without Facebook and Twitter. I have this conversation with my wife all the time where I'll do something like buying, specifically I think of always of buying plane tickets. Like I'm just a little bit younger than you are. And so I can definitely remember the world without the internet, but I can't remember, because the internet came along when I was the proliferation of the internet came along when I was about 12 or so. I've definitely never bought a plane ticket without the internet. Right. And mm-hmm. So I say this to my wife all the time, like, how did we do stuff before the internet? Like, how do we buy a plane ticket? And I guess we got a phone book and called an airline, and it's so foreign to me now. And I just think about those kind of tasks that aren't everyday tasks that make it so difficult to function without the internet. And I wonder if that, did that seem like a particular challenge to you?
Shane, I was crushed by the airline ticket. The airline ticket killed me. I tried so hard to find a way, even going to the point of calling the Harvard University travel agency. That's where my husband was working, and saying, you know, can you do it for me? Well, of course they could, but it was going to cost literally hundreds of dollars more.
Oh, yeah.
So I ended up letting my husband take that one. The other one that killed me was a parking garage. I was legalistic. I was so legalistic that I wouldn't even enter my card into a computer, because I recognized that to be electronic communication.
Right.
And the fact is, there are parking garages that you literally can't get out of without doing that.
Yeah.
So I had to give it up for a parking garage.
Well, one of the more like entertaining passages from the book was you doing your taxes. And when I was reading that, I said, that's one that I definitely, if I were in your shoes, would have passed on to my spouse, because you got like printed forms and did your taxes like manually, like on a kitchen table with no computer. That's impressive.
With two different states too, and a move right in the middle. Oh. But I had to. And it was such an important moment for me that I did that, because I I learned something about my finances and about my self-sufficiency in that moment that I'm not sure I could have learned any other way. I had so many years thought of my taxes as this kind of game that you play where there's like the red team and the green team. I know that sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, no. Right?
Like you're winning or you're losing and you're playing this game. It was incredible for me to realize that that there was a factual basis for it and that I had complete knowledge of that. I actually knew where every penny was and how much the taxes were and what exactly I was being charged for what. And it was a moment I got up from that table lighter than I had been before, realizing that there's a whole world out there, literally on the other side of the internet, this whole world that I needed and wanted to have some control over and some ability to function in. And I could do it. I wasn't hopeless.
Well, and it seems like that really kind of opened up a real change in just you and your husband's financial life as well, beyond just taxes.
Well, we went out of debt. And in fact, my life now, I live now off the grid and a self-built yurt and cabin in the woods of Idaho. And that entire lifestyle is really grounded in an understanding of money, finances, not only how we spend them, and how we spend money and how we get money, but also how money moves through the whole world. How the things that we consume and how we pay for them is actually supporting systems that go back to other human beings, other creatures. It was mind-blowing at the time and kind of still is when I stop and think about what a dollar really means. And that's where it started for me, was right there at that kitchen table doing my taxes with a number two pencil and an eraser.
It's so fascinating to me how so many people, and especially I think from our generation, kind of walk around with debt as some kind of like badge of honor. And definitely I think there are people who don't have debt because they love money so much. But I think one of the things that you kept emphasizing was just the freedom that you felt from it.
Yeah, and the ability to live with integrity. The thing that concerns me about debt is that you don't have the option of saying, I won't buy this cheaper thing because it's not going to fit with my values. Instead, I need to take this more expensive choice because that's where my heart is. And that's where my faith and my belief system is leading me. When I think about freedom from debt, I really think about the ability to put every single dollar right where I want it to go and to shape the world accordingly. So it's a freedom, but it's actually a very heavy freedom that comes with a lot of responsibility. And I think it's one that not only do we shirk as a culture, but we're strongly encouraged to shirk by those who benefit from our not being careful with our money and allowing those debt relationships to control us.
Do you feel like, because you are on the internet now, I mean, you're literally on the internet as we speak.
I am.
But you have a presence online. You blog, you're on Facebook and Twitter and have a YouTube channel. Do you feel like you have a good moderation as far as the internet's concerned?
You know, God made me one way. And I am always the person who loves to do things in extremes. I am always the fire person. I always burn hot. And I've tried to change who I am. But I think what I've learned is that I build systems around who I am that are functional. So right now, I literally do not have internet in the place where I sleep. I literally only have internet for a few hours a day. And yes, that works. That's very manageable. Could I do it from sheer willpower? Shane, I'm not sure that I could. Honestly, I think I need that kind of structure because I still am who I am.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I could definitely not do it from willpower. I was just thinking as I was reading the book about my own addiction to the internet. And mostly my phone. Like, I will check my phone at a stoplight. And I mean, like, it brings me no joy to admit this. Like, every stoplight. Like any chance I get to, if I can just pull up my phone and look at it. Because in a 5 minute time, there's a decent chance that someone has either, that there's some kind of notification from either Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or an email or a text. Like those are five avenues with which someone could have sent me some sort of notification in the last 5 minutes. And I think it's just designed to be so, well, addictive. I don't know any other word for it than to, like, there's this, like, you know, dopamine that goes to your brain every time you get one of those little notifications.
Precisely. And the smartphones really bring it up a notch. It's interesting because I was in a way prescient when I was talking about my addiction experiences in 2009. At that point, the phone that I had given up was a flip phone. Remember those?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Not even a smartphone.
Right. So I was actually a little ahead of the level of addiction that I think many of us are experiencing now, because the smartphones really are built a different way. You know, my husband will tease me that he'll put his hand out for me to rub my thumb on. I want to rub my thumb on something.
That's
but
a great coping
mechanism. That's a real thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things I was thinking about too, when I was thinking about it, is anybody has any kind of a job outside the home, usually the internet is required in some way. A lot of people would get in a lot of trouble at their place of work if they went an hour without responding to an email or a text or something like that. And it seems really similar to people who have food addictions and talk about how difficult it is, because that's not something you can quit cold turkey, right? Like we still have to eat for sustenance. You know, it's not like smoking or drinking where you can say like, I will just stay away from it, you know, permanently. And for so many people, that's the way we are required to carry this thing with us at all times that is also extremely addictive.
Yeah, one of the most embarrassing things about my project at the beginning, and even now, is that I had limited awareness of the privilege I was experiencing by being able to be a stay-at-home mom. And I have to give myself slack, because it really was a painful transition for me coming from the workforce into being a stay-at-home mom. But I didn't realize at the time how unusual it was for me to be able to drop off the internet completely. And I didn't realize until very near the end of my experiment what an incredible gift I had been given. I talked near the end about trying to stock up for the rest of my life, because I knew that the reality of my life would be interacting, going back and forth, trying to create boundaries and structures and solutions. And this kind of paradise of silence was a momentary thing, a thing to be missed.
One of the other things I think about with just the internet being around us all the time, and I think it's something you kind of alluded to a little bit in the book, that we're inundated with bad news on the internet all the time from around the world. And like, I mean, like legitimately bad news, you know, like I can know about, you know, a car bomb that goes off somewhere across the world, or some natural disaster, or just really dark things that happen all over the world in a way that I don't think we used to be aware of. Like even just, you know, obviously like 100 years ago, we were aware of those things, but even just before the internet, when we just had newspapers or the nightly news. And I find myself wondering a lot if like God just made us to be able to handle and take care of and respond to the bad news immediately around us. And if maybe we're just not capable of handling the entirety of the world's bad news every day.
And it's not just bad news. It's bad news without the ability, in most cases, to have a meaningful response.
That's
the thing that I consider to be such a concern, is that we feel empathy. As God made us, we have hearts to feel. And so I find out that this is happening, and I my heart wants to reach out and embrace that problem, whatever it is. But because of the distance and because of my own busyness and overwhelm, I may not be able to do that. So what naturally happens is that I create some numbness, some defense mechanism, because I can't do what is the authentic human response. And so then we build these very, very thick skins, which then, unfortunately, I think that dynamic comes back to our families and our homes, that we are more numb and more concerned with our screens than we are with the feelings of the person next to us, because we've become habitual at shutting out this constant awareness of harm and suffering.
And I think, too, that I think it's a proven phenomenon that when people have too many choices, they're more likely to not choose any of them. And I think, mm-hmm. and I think about that in relation to what we're talking about. I mean, I've got good friends that I know personally who do really good work in Iraq. And I could help out with that. You know, I could give money and those things, and I do those things sometimes. But thanks to the internet, like, I'm bombarded with tons of other choices that are also really good choices, but I think at the end of the day, sometimes make me choose to do nothing. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's so overwhelming. But I feel like that's always been the promise. You know, we've always been told that there are many wrong ways and few right ways. And it takes some discipline to hold on to your best path, whether that is in the company of all this information from the internet, or if you restrict the information coming from the internet. In both senses, you're going to have some discipline to be able to say, I choose this, I follow it through, I have the satisfaction of having a meaningful response to suffering.
One of the other things that really changed in your life was your marriage. And I say changed, it seems like that dramatically improved. The funny thing about what kind of happened in your life over this year was that, you know, in some ways it's like, yes, you had this time that you didn't have before because you weren't on the internet, but some of these things weren't, it's not like you so much said, like, now I have more time to concentrate on my marriage, but having a better marriage was just a byproduct of no internet.
Mm-hmm. It was very accidental. But that's the only way it could have been. Again, with this God planting seeds and jokes. I mean, the first thing that Nick said to me when I said I was going for a year without the internet was, oh, so you're trying to live in 1980 for some reason, you know? And it was just, it wasn't particularly kind. It wasn't cruel either, but he just thought it was a joke. And then not 3 months later, he was saying to me, I'm glad you're doing this. This is helping. This is helping our family work. Not 3 months later, he was expecting me to sit down and have a conversation with him literally every night when he got home from work, which I guess doesn't sound so strange, except we had really never done it before. I guess it was strange. We really just benefited from open space, the space to be humans together. And neither one of us really pulled out any miracles. Nobody said the right thing or did the right thing. We just had space to recover, and our marriage recovered too.
So a huge part of your story is reconnecting with your faith again after that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny when I just hear bits and pieces of a story like yours, I assume that people somehow get over their skeptical questions and then return to church and in faith. But more often, and this was the case for your story, it seems like there was just something that drew you back to the experience of being with believers. So for you, it was kind of finding yourself wandering into this church for reasons you couldn't quite articulate, and then just being kind of romanced by that experience of faith from other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I ended up right back where I had seen my mother. I ended up now, I mean, even now, my skeptical questions are not entirely answered. And I'm certainly not done being concerned about how the Christian church as an entity moves through the world, particularly in American evangelical Christianity. I'm not done with all those questions, but the core of my faith became overpowering. I came to understand that there is something simple and pure, and that what's magical is that that does matter. The complexities and the kind of human expressions of faith actually don't win. The simplicity of being healed in faith by Jesus Christ really started to win for me. But I'm glad you noticed that I had the experience of being compelled, because there just isn't another way it would have happened, Shane. I was so anti-Christian. I was so not able to just suddenly pop into church one day. You know, if it hadn't been a very strong pull, I would never have made the change.
For someone like me who, definitely has my doubts, but I'm, at this point, like, pretty sold out on Team Jesus. And I just think, in the world today, how does anyone ever come to faith, especially if they either drifted from the faith they had as a child or just never had any at all? How does anyone ever come to faith? Because kind of what you were alluding to, we've got so many bad examples of Christian faith today in the media and what have you. And I look at that and I think, well, I'm pretty disgusted by that as well. How would anyone ever come to faith? And I think it's just so comforting to know that one, God has not stopped wooing people to himself because of that. And God is working, despite all that.
Mm-hmm. I have a beautiful story. I feel like I've been gifted a beautiful story from a beautiful God, saying that, yes, this is possible. These kinds of a story of healing and of positive change and hope is possible. And I really do feel a certain responsibility to spread that story among my Christian friends as well as among my atheist friends, just to say it's not as simple or as broken or as dead as you might think. I've seen it happen. I have seen things grow in ground that I thought was not fertile. And that's the story that I have been gifted and the story I'm trying to share.
Do you feel like now it's easier to see God at work in the world, whether that be through interpersonal relationships and people or just creation around you, now that the internet and even a lot of modern trappings for you don't kind of dominate your landscape?
Certainly. I live in the woods, and I experience God in the woods. I experience God in the rising of the sun and the setting of the sun and the starlight and the changing of the seasons. And it sounds cliche. I mean, I think my own teenage or young adult self would have said that is ridiculous. You know, stop it, right? That's just too much feeling, too emotional. But it's the reality of my day-to-day life, basically living in the woods. I experience God in the most tangible and reassuring ways as I move around through the natural world and through the beauty of my home.
Well, Esther, I so much enjoyed reading your words in your book, and it's been so good to get to talk with you today. Thanks for being on the show.
I really appreciate it, Shane. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah.